Good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. How you doing? You okay? Terrible news from Omaha today. Just absolutely mind-boggling. Christmas shoppers. There is absolutely nothing I can say about that except to acknowledge that it did happen and move on. There is an increasing number of people in the country now who are starting to realize, I think, if not realize, become very, very suspicious of Bush's sanity. They're starting to realize that he truly should be under some kind of supervision, medical supervision. I'm serious as a heart attack here. Doug Thompson, writing for Capitol Hill Blue, kind of put the topper on it when he was talking about. He wrote today. If you go to Capitol Hill Blue and check out what he read, what he wrote today about the madness in Bush's eyes. I think anyone who watched that press briefing the other day, as Kathy and I did, as you may have, became very aware early on in that press conference that the man behind that podium, or pulpit, as he almost called it, is not in complete control of his, what's the term, faculties. He is not. This is a person who has spent his entire life denying reality. This is what Bush on the couch, part of it, what Justin Frank was talking about, all the way back to when his little sister died, and his parents didn't even have a funeral, and he wasn't allowed to talk about it. This guy's entire life has been deeply embedded in denial. And as he said the other day, oh, it's going time to do psychology 101 on me, huh? No, we're not going to do psychology 101, not at all. But to listen to him, yeah, most of his thinking, I listened to those sound bites again today that we played for you last night. And to listen to George Bush standing there utterly and absolutely denying reality. If it's something, if a report is given to him and it disagrees with his position on whatever, he ignores the report. If a report is given to him that states the opposite of what Bush is on the record as saying, he ignores the report. If it is something he doesn't want to hear, he ignores the report. I mean, this is pretty astonishing, and I think we are fast approaching the time when somebody, somehow, since Nancy Pelosi, the gatekeeper for the impeachment hearings in the House Judiciary Committee, since Nancy Pelosi somehow has become like a giant clog in a toilet someplace, and the commode is backing up all through the House, our House. Since she refuses to do her job or to stand aside and let the Constitution do its job, I think the time is fast approaching when there's going to have to be some sort of concerted effort, maybe extra constitutionally, to remove this man from office, peacefully and legally, but to remove him from office. The more I think about this NIE, and how Dick Cheney, apparently Cheney, and or Bush kept it quiet for months, possibly as long as a year. And then George Bush stood there yesterday and said, I only found out about it a week ago. I mean, this is the kind of lying that goes way beyond anything Dick Nixon did, anything, as far as I know, that any president has ever done. George Bush put this country on the verge of utter and absolute destruction with his madness about the Middle East. Let me share something with you, and we'll probably get a commercial break in here, but I'm going to do it in two parts. Chris Hedges, writing in the December 10th issue of The Nation, I want to quote a bit from his piece. Hedges writes, an attack on Iran And this is before this NIE came out. An attack on Iran, which appears increasingly likely before the coming presidential election, will unleash a regional conflict of catastrophic proportions. This war, and especially Iranian retaliatory strikes on American targets, will be used to silence domestic dissent and abolish what is left of our civil liberties. It will solidify the slow-motion coup d'etat that has been underway since the 9/11 attacks. It could mean the death of this republic. Let me pause from what Hedges wrote. This is massively, monumentally serious stuff. And I don't think 25 or 30% of the American population is aware of where we stand right now and where Bush was trying to take us. And I do believe that the intelligence community and certain high-ranking military officers made certain that NIE was made public to stop Bush and Cheney. I'm beginning to believe that deeply, that this was not an effort to keep the American public apprised of what was going on. This is not some political ploy to affect the presidential campaign. This was an attempt by the intelligence and military establishment, the upper levels, to stop George Bush in his tracks before he took this country and the Middle East and possibly the world into a nuclear holocaust. George Bush is deranged. He is absolutely out of his mind. Chris writes, "Let us hope sanity prevails, but sanity is a rare commodity in a White House that has twisted Trotsky's concept of permanent revolution into a policy of permanent war with nefarious aims to intimidate and destroy all those classified as foreign opponents, to create permanent instability and fear, and to strip citizens of their constitutional rights. A war with Iran is doomed. It will be no more successful than the Israeli airstrikes on Lebanon in 2006, which failed to break Hezbollah and united most Lebanese behind that militant group. The Israeli bombing did not pacify 4 million Lebanese. What will happen when we begin to pound a country of 65 million people whose landmass is three times the size of France? Once you begin an air campaign, it is only a matter of time before you have to put troops on the ground or accept defeat, as the Israelis had to do in Lebanon. And if we begin dropping bunker busters and cruise missiles on Iran, this is the choice that must be faced. Either send U.S. forces into Iran to fight a protracted and futile guerrilla war, or walk away in humiliation. But more ominous, an attack on Iran will ignite the Middle East. The loss of Iranian oil, coupled with possible silkworm missile attacks by Iran against oil tankers in the Persian Gulf, could send the price of oil soaring to somewhere around $200 a barrel. The effect on the domestic and world economy will be devastating, very possibly triggering a global depression. The Middle East has two-thirds of the world's proven petroleum reserves and nearly half its natural gas. A disruption in the supply will be felt immediately. This attack will be interpreted by many Shiites in the Middle East as a religious war. The 2 million Shiites in Saudi Arabia, heavily concentrated in the oil-rich eastern province, the Shiite majority in Iraq, and the Shiite communities in Bahrain, Pakistan, and Turkey could turn in rage on us and our dwindling allies. Now, we're going to break here. I'll finish this when we come back. This is what Cheney has been pushing this country to do, and this is what Bush, the most dangerous leader this country has ever had, has been going along with. This is very serious stuff. Cheney, I think, is just totally insane. Bush is a madman. This is not America. No, this is not.
Western world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war.
Sometimes I'm happy, you know, this is, but wars are not a time of joy. These aren't joyous times.
21 past the hour, the madness of our two executives, president, vice president, is it borders on the unreal. Going back now to Chris Hedges' article in, or I should say op-ed piece, column, whatever, in the December 10th issue of The Nation, wherein he describes what will happen. Now, this is before the NRE that said Iran has no nuclear weapons program and hasn't for 4 years, which casts in incredible relief the lies that Bush and Cheney and the rest of this administration have been telling us. They have to be removed from office. They just must. So Hedges is writing from the standpoint of an oncoming war with Iran, which Bush still refuses to acknowledge is not going to happen. Hedges writes, we could see a combination of increased terrorist attacks, including on American soil, and widespread sabotage of oil production in the Persian Gulf. Iraq, as bad as it looks now, will become a death pit for U.S. troops. The Supreme Islamic Iraqi Council, which has so far not joined the insurgency, has strong ties to Iran. It could begin full-scale guerrilla resistance, possibly uniting for the first time with Sunnis against the occupation. Iran, in retaliation for our attack, will fire its missiles, some with a range of 1,100 miles, at U.S. installations, including Baghdad's Green Zone. Expect substantial casualties, especially with Iranian agents and their Iraqi allies calling in precise coordinates. Iranian missiles could be launched at Israel. The Strait of Hormuz, which is the corridor for 20% of the world's oil supply, will become treacherous, perhaps unnavigable. Chinese-supplied anti-missiles, anti-ship missiles, mines and coastal artillery, along with speedboats packed with explosives and suicide bombers, will target U.S. shipping, along with Saudi oil production and oil export centers. Hezbollah forces in southern Lebanon, closely allied with Iran, may in solidarity fire rockets into northern Israel. Israel, already struck by missiles from Tehran, could then carry out retaliatory raids against both Lebanon and Iran. Pakistan, with its huge Shiite minority, will become even more unstable. Unrest could result in the overthrow of the already weakened Pervez Musharraf and usher Islamic radicals into power. Pakistan, rather than Iran, would then become the first radical Islamic state to possess a nuclear weapon. The neat little war with Iran, which many Democrats do not oppose, has the potential to ignite an inferno. George W. Bush has shredded, violated, or absented America from its obligations under international law. He has refused to ratify the Kyoto Protocol, backed out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, tried to kill the International Criminal Court, walked out on negotiations on chemical and biological weapons, and defied the Geneva Conventions and human rights law in the treatment of detainees. Most egregious, he launched an illegal war in Iraq based on fabricated evidence we now know had been discredited even before it was made public. He seeks to do the same in Iran. This president is guilty, in short, of what in legal circles is known as the crime of aggression. And if we as citizens do not hold him accountable for this crime, if we do not actively defy this government, we will be complicit in the codification of a new world order, one that will have terrifying consequences. For a world without treaties, statutes, and laws is a world where any nation, from a rogue nuclear state to a great imperial power, will be able to invoke its domestic laws to annul its obligations to others. This new order will undo 5 decades of international cooperation largely put in place by the United States and thrust us into a Hobbesian nightmare. We must, as citizens, make sacrifices to defend a world where diplomacy, broad cooperation, and the law are respected. If we allow these international legal systems to unravel, we will destroy the possibility of cooperation between nation states, including our closest allies. The strongest institutional barrier standing between us and a war with Iran is being mounted by Defense Secretary Robert Gates, Admiral William Fallon, head of the Central Command, and George Casey, the Army's new chief of staff. These three men have informed Bush in Congress that the military is too depleted to take on another conflict and may not be able to contain or cope effectively with a regional conflagration resulting from strikes on Iran. This line of defense, however, is tenuous. Not only can Gates, Fallon, and Casey easily be replaced, but a provocation by Iran could be used by war propagandists here to stoke a public clamor for revenge. A country that exists in a state of permanent war cannot exist as a democracy. Our long row of candles is being snuffed out. We may soon be in darkness. Any resistance, however symbolic, is essential.
I am just to justify, Mama, do you please? That cowboy can be fatal, can make you paranoid, can make you maladjusted, a person to avoid. You rave against the terrorists, then murder like they do. You even claim the peaceniks, terrorizing you. Your old friends and allies, you see as enemies. It's mighty freaking dangerous, mad cowboy disease. Mad cowboy disease, mad cowboy disease.
I regret I have to tell you right in war. I never wanted to be a war president.
But that's how it goes. It is the people living the
poor. 25 before the hour. I would ask, I never do this, but I would ask tonight, if you do decide to call the program, to consider what to do about the fact that we have two insane people running the country, Bush and Cheney. They're the ones that are in control. I don't want you to come up with anything inflammatory or something that's going to, we're just going to have to bleep. That'd be very easy to do, but there's certain things we can and can't say. But it is to the point, when you consider what Chris Hedges wrote at The Nation, then consider what was written today at Capitol Hill Blue, Doug Thompson, and what people have been saying, what we've said on this program for the past couple of years. I'm not ashamed to take credit for having pointed out this man's madness. What Justin Frank has been saying, what Al Franken has been saying. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on and on of people. And I mention these names, and I put myself in there simply for the diversity of, you got people on the right, people on the left, entertainers, people who do talk radio, people who pick their nose. It doesn't matter. Maybe you've been saying it to your friends. Maybe it's been talked about in your civic group or your church or your association or with your golfing buddies or at work or in cubicle world or in wherever. If you work in television or radio, surely you have become aware. Now, again, the insanity of these two is clearly, clearly defined. There is no doubt here that we're dealing with a president who has either no concept of what his dancing with death is doing or doesn't care. And then we have a vice president who is literally insane. This guy is demonic. We also have a news media that refuses to fight these sons of bitches head on. which is what their obligation, their responsibility truly is. It's the only profession that the framers gave constitutional protection to. When you are afforded that kind of acknowledgement, you have a tremendous burden on your back to do your goddamn job. And they will not. It goes from the gibbering insanity at Fox News to the offhand, casual, let's give it 2 minutes at the top of the newscast, bull crap that you find on CBS, NBC, and ABC, to the blithering nonsense of Wolf Blitzer on CNN. I mean, just on and on. There is one newsman on television who is fighting like a son of a bitch against these people, and that's Keith Olbermann. You know, we really do have, it is still solvable. I believe that. I believe what we're faced with is solvable. And I believe what we saw with the release of this National Intelligence Estimate, this thing that came out last week, what we have seen is an absolute, deliberate move on the part of the intelligence and the military upper echelons to stop these bastards. Now, in some other country, it would be a coup. A military coup is how you stop someone who is destroying your country, or someone whom you want to get out of power. I'm not saying that people who commit military coups are national saviors or interested in democracy. I mean, by definition, a military coup is anti-democratic, by definition. But in so many countries, when enough of the ruling class, whether that is business, military, intelligence, education, the intelligentsia, whatever, when enough of the ruling class determines that the leadership of the country is taking the country someplace where it dare not go, then movement begins to remove that leader and his cohorts. Sometimes it's, well, what happened to Tsar Nicholas. Sometimes it's what happened to Mussolini. Sometimes it's what happened to Hitler. Sometimes it's what happened to the, you can just go on and on and on and on. At some point, enough people within a society that is being run by a cadre that is determined to destroy that society, the foundation of that society, its rule of law, its constitution, its agreements with nations, its treaties, everything. Bush has done this at some point. Dear God, there's an either-or situation. Either the resistance comes out of the closet and begins fully frontal, deliberate, or the country's gone and something else replaces it. Or the system under which the country has been governing itself is gone and something else replaces it. We are so close to that. We are so close to that. How many of us, I can think of a few of us when I worked at Air America. Randy Rhodes has been talking about this. I've been talking about it. Tom Hartman's been talking about it. Who else? Sam Cedar? Who else? Just Peter Werby's been talking about it. Who else? Can you? Jeff Farias has been talking about it. I'm sure some of the liberal talk show hosts, progressive talk show hosts who are buried under in a radio station someplace under an avalanche of right-wing slugs and thugs have been talking about it. But truth seekers, we are here. Do you understand this? We're right here. We're right here. And what we've seen in the past couple of days is an attempt to without firing a shot, without seizing the presidential palace, so to speak, without declaring not Bush and Cheney, but the military declaring a state of emergency in which they have to take over if the republic is going to continue as a republic. Without any of that, we have seen an effort. And that was the release of this NIE. Now, a lot of people say, well, the NIE was not all that specific. It didn't say Bush and Cheney are lying. It didn't have to. It's right there. And all we need to know, the only thing that is absolutely pertinent, is what the NIE said about the time frame. 2003 was when this stopped. And now it's 2007. The other thing that is astonishing about this, Bush claiming that no one gave him the details of this intel report until a few days ago. What? What? Everybody in the upper levels of the Bush crime family and the upper levels of the intelligence community and the upper levels of the military understand that a year ago, 10 months ago, if we want to take that time frame, and I say that's nonsense. It was long before that. But 10, 12 months ago, everyone understood. Wait a second. There's a report out. According to all of our 16 different intelligence agencies, including people on the ground in Iran, people in Iran who are opposed to Ahmadinejad and these mullahs. I mean, it is irrefutable. I don't care what these mouth-slobbering sons of bitches on right-wing talk radio and television are saying. This evidence is irrefutable. There is no doubt here. There is not a nuclear weapons program and hasn't been for 4 years. Everybody knows this, and we are to believe that this information is ricocheting around the upper levels of the decision makers in this country, as sick and degenerate as they are, and Bush doesn't know? That's what he wants us to believe. That's what he said at the press briefing 2 days ago, or yesterday. I just found out about this a week ago. If that is true, see, we're in another either-or situation. Either Bush is a liar to a degree that is astounding, or he is not the head of this government. Someone else is. There is no halfway ground here. I don't know. You tell me. What do you think ought to happen?
Standing up to the flying monkey right, it's more of Mike Malloy.
You know that's a game that I hate to lose.
It's about 10 before the hour. All right, we're going to leave that topic for a while and revisit it a little bit later in the program tonight. Coming up in about 40 minutes, we're going to have Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Huh? One of the favorite features of this program. We have a story to share with you entitled Day One. And you're going to love it, kiddies. But right now, let's move on. We've got some calls here, and I see there's somebody on the phone here that I really want to bring on the program, and that is Victor from North Carolina. My God, you're in North Carolina, Victor?
Well, Well, right now I am, yeah. I was here just last night, actually. Late.
Are you totally out of the clutches of...
I'm sorry to cut you off there.
Completely,
no probation, no parole, no... No more time.
For the people who don't know, Victor Lopez is someone who, I mentioned this before, he's someone who used to listen to my program when I was on Air America. I think before that on IE America, he used to listen in Miami, where he's being held at Miami Detention Center on nonviolent charges, had to do with check kiting and credit card fraud, if I'm not mistaken. And Victor wound up stuck in jail in Puerto Rico and has really struggled over the past. How long have you been incarcerated?
Around 4 years and 10 months. I stopped counting after about the four. It just got numb.
Well, Victor used to write to me about how he and his fellow inmates at the Miami Correctional Center used to listen to the program on, I guess, WINZ?
Yeah, it was 9:40 a.m.
Yeah.
Talk radio. I'm not sure what the call letters were, but it was 9:40, and there was quite a few. I'd say a good, I probably knew about 900, not by name, of course, but knew about 900 people that probably listened to your
Wow! Talk about a captive audience.
Oh, you're not lying. Yeah. It's a very captive audience. Yeah.
And then Victor got transferred out of the country and out of the continental United States to Puerto Rico, and it was real panic time. I remember some of the early letters that Victor wrote me.
Wow.
I wished there was something I could have done. At one sentencing hearing, Victor asked me to write what is referred to as good boy letter. You write to the judge and say, look. This person you're about to sentence doesn't deserve. You try to build a case for the person, and so I did that because Victor asked me to do it, and I felt like I had gotten to know him through his letters. Well, to make a long story short, our good friend Sarge heard about Victor, and they started corresponding. A lot of you wrote to Victor while he was in jail. And Victor started writing at the website that Sarge worked at, and I believe you are now you're the floating editor.
Yeah, I'm floating. I barely have my feet down, but I'm a computer. Well, was a computer guru. I'm definitely getting my feet wet again. It's hard. It's real hard when you come out after being held in a closet or being held in a concrete mausoleum for so long. What happens is, people pass by you and you say, well, Jesus, these people, everything's so fast, you almost want to hold the, I was in Miami International and I could bear, the smells, the tastes, the looks, it's been a little bit to get some used to. It's going to take some getting used to again.
You've had almost 5 years of sensory deprivation, except noise and clanging doors.
Yeah, clanging doors and
lights that don't go out.
And I've actually been detained in the higher security facility. I've been in detention centers the whole time. Miami's a detention center.
Right.
Puerto Rico was. The Virgin Islands was a nightmare. Well, they're all nightmares. But I spent near 5 years. I say 5 years with Good Time. It was 5 years, but it was a lot of detention and a lot of needing alternate activities. I wrote, I wrote. So many people wrote. I mean, so many great people wrote. It lifted me up because I at that point I was actually in the solitary confinement. And letters started coming in. I said, "Well, who in the hell knows where I'm at, and who are these people?" And before you knew it, the guards got used to it. They were bringing in bales of mail from Mike Malloy listeners all over the place. And every now and then we'd get a stupid hate letter in there, and you get hate letters. But overall, it was overwhelming in a good sense. I started off my day writing, and I walked a lot better. Knowing that that there was people out there that cared. Mm-hmm. I mean, it made a lot of difference. I mean,
you got letters. If I remember, Victor, you got some letters from overseas, not from this country, didn't you?
Oh yeah, I have letters from Japan, Scotland, the United Kingdom. Matter of fact, one of my correspondents just called me from the United Kingdom this evening, and I've been on the phone all day. I finally got the password. Now I don't have to write. It was very complicated. I'd have to write and. Send my columns out. There was two people, Deborah and Annie, one in Colorado, one in Virginia Beach, and they would type it up for me and turn it in. So I mean, it was a long process. They went from my room, when there's no spell check on a piece of paper, with my dictionary, and I would send it out after it was read. You know, they have to read it before it sends it out. So I had to water down. You can't say everything you want to when you have that. So it was.
Victor, we're coming up on a break, but I want you to hold on because when we, if you don't mind, if
no problem, no, I have all the time in the world.
Hold on, you do, don't you?
Yeah, I sure do.
I want you to hold on because I want to give you a chance to talk directly to all those people who collectively, all those people who took the time to respond to what we had on our website and what we used to talk about, and not just us. There are other people who were working to try to stay in contact with you for a number of reasons. So hold on, if you will. We'll come back and talk in a second right after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. It's about 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy Program on Nova M Radio Network. We're talking with Victor Lopez,
yes,
who spent a lot of time listening to this program when he first found it, listening in the Miami Correctional Institute with fellow inmates, and then got transferred to a detention center in Puerto Rico. He fought like hell to get a fair shake from the courts, and by that I mean... well, literally, to get a fair shake. Did he violate the law? Well, obviously he did. Was it a crime of violence? No, it was not. Victor, you've had a pretty weird journey, especially when you stopped. How old were you when you were first busted?
I was 21, actually. I was just able to buy alcohol at the airport with my ID. That's how young I was. I was in Chicago. It was still a new thing to get ID, for alcohol.
Without going into detail, because we have a time restriction here, what were you charged with, and ultimately, what were you convicted of?
Well, basically, in a nutshell, what happened is I went down to the Virgin Islands, the U.S., Virgin Islands, and we took over an existing business. And we post-dated checks, me and my business partner, post-dated checks. And what happened was when those checks came due, the vendors actually cashed them, thinking that we would be able to make good on them, but we weren't. I was thrown in jail, and my business partner killed himself, afraid to go to jail, obviously. And what happened then was I was held in the Virgin Islands jail, was abused considerably by officers, actually, and... Then was eventually moved to the States. But it was initially it was only the bounce. It was only the post-dated checks, Mike.
Good God! So you were first busted in the Virgins. You were sent back to Miami, and then
for my protection, I was sent to Miami. They were actually beating to show you the common sense of the employees of the correctional facility there. They actually beat me, thinking they could extort me for money. However, common sense would provide that if I had bounced checks, I couldn't afford much of anything. So it was a nasty situation.
God. So why did your case and you wind up in Puerto Rico?
Well, what happened was, in order to keep me from being seriously beat, the federal government had to step in and grab me out of that jail. The U.S. government did. Otherwise, I was going to lose my life over there. And all I did was, you know, bounce checks. Mm-hmm. And it was vicious culture of violence in the islands. And they really despised me for my speech and for I was different. I was a normal guy, and I was going in there with some real criminals. People wanted for murders and drug trafficking and things like that. So they actually moved me to Puerto Rico and held me, but sentenced me without me even being there, sentenced me in absentia.
I remember when you wrote to me about that. How were you able to maintain whatever it takes, especially in a person as young as you? How were you able to maintain, I'm not sure I want to say your sanity, but your equilibrium? That's a better word.
Well, I've always called you my agnostic angel. My atheist angel out there, because I don't know how I did it, Mike. I've had a hard knock life, even though I don't look like it. Never can judge a book by its cover, but I just put one foot in front of the other, Mike, and I didn't let anybody rain on my parade. And when they did, I got over it pretty quickly. Because what can you do? You know, you just keep on walking and you keep on trying to do what you have to do to make it through to the next day. And that's how you do it in jail. At least that's how I did it.
How are you feeling now? I'm talking about your interior. I mean, you've been through some hell here, Victor, and. Talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. How you know you're going to have to deal with that, right?
Yeah, I was talking to Elaine, and I believe Elaine emailed you. Elaine's like my mother now. And, I have to take this day by day. It's overwhelming. It's something, at least I have enough brain power to know that it's actually that's not going to be too easy. But I'm going to get over it. I'm going to take one day at a time. I'm not going to let them rob me of me. So, I'm basically going to take it one day at a time. I'm going to enroll in school. I'm going to, again, do the same thing I did in jail, put one foot in front of the other until finally things become normal again.
Are you feeling shaky inside? Are you feeling stable?
I feel stable, but I feel like this whole experience had been so unreal since the beginning that I actually came to a point where I thought it would never end. And I think you would see where I would write you and I would tell you, Mike, I can't tell you for sure. I didn't know, even up to the point when they told me, Mr. Lopez, you're free to walk away, I almost looked at, where's the candid camera at?
Right.
You know, but actually, I think I'll be all right, Mike. It's going to be a hard road, but I have a huge support system thanks to you.
Well, not thanks to me. Thanks to you.
Well,
I have to tell you, when your letters first started coming, and I watched some sort of a growing process in you, and I hate to get into psychobabble here.
No.
I'm not going to do it. But
yeah.
There were times when you were in Miami where I could sense that you were just holding on by your fingernails.
Yeah, I was by a thin thread. I was holding on.
You somehow found that center and you pulled yourself around. And all of a sudden, when you wrote to me and told me that this deluge of letters was coming in from people who didn't know you, who had no idea what you were about, it was only because we mentioned it a couple of times on the radio, and all of a sudden, and then when you started writing, I think that was the turning point.
Yeah, that actually gave me, would you believe, of course you would believe, you're a writer, and whenever I began to write, it was like just pouring out your heart, and actually people would write me with their problems,
yeah.
Believe it or not, some of them, and I would gladly answer them,
sure,
and I would gladly give them, and it was a real experience, and I was okay with writing, but I actually started to get better as time went, and a little bit more confident, and I came out of my shell a little bit, and I mean, I wrote upwards of 60 letters to sometimes 65 letters a week.
Uh-huh.
So I mean, my hand is well calloused. No,
wow,
but,
65 letters a week.
It could be up to 65. It depends on I actually
all handwritten, like the ones you sent to me.
All handwritten. Every now and then I got fancy and I brought out the typewriter. But other than that, it was nothing. It was I loved doing it. I loved doing it. I would absolutely love doing it. I'd fix me a cup of that disgusting instant coffee and go to work, and it would just be fun. And it it actually helped me through the time. You would not imagine how fast it made my time and how centered it made me. I can't explain it.
Well, up to this point in your story, and Victor, from your writing to me, you know, I know now quite a bit about your life prior to the check charges, and you know, without really commenting on that, because you know, truth is, everybody's got a story, but having known a little bit about you from what you told me, and then going through as a spectator, I'm not saying I went through this with you.
Yes,
you went through it by yourself. But watching from the standpoint of reading your letters, I'm just absolutely convinced that you've got a tremendously rewarding future ahead of you. You're a survivor. You're I'll tell you what you are, pal. You're a happy ending here at this point to a story that over the past couple, 3-4 years really had me concerned.
Yeah.
I there are many times Kathy and I would read your letters and just kind of sit there. I'd go to the post office, pick them up out of the P.O. box. We'd sit in the car out in the parking lot, read them, and I'd say, Jesus, God, what do you think is going to happen? We would just kind of sit there and look at each other, both of us afraid to say anything, so we wouldn't. We would just read the letter and then drive home.
Yeah.
But you are a happy ending. Do you understand that?
I really do, believe it or not.
I'm not saying your life is.
No, but it doesn't happen. I mean, Mike, life is one hell of a roller coaster. But I tell you, the beautiful thing about it is that I'm 26 years old and I have a whole hell of a lot of future. And and because of good people like you, I can actually be myself now. And
all
I can
right.
actually be
listen, Victor. Again, no credit here. Listen. We got to go. Please,
no
please stay in touch.
Absolutely.
Call the program. Let's talk. You got stuff to say, okay?
Absolutely. Thanks.
All right. Victor, congratulations, man. I love you like a brother, like a son. I'm glad you're out.
Those who say you can't win this thing militarily. That's exactly what the United States military says, that you can't win this military.
It is 21 past the hour. It was good to hear from Victor. For folks who don't know what the whole story was, I hope that quick sketch gave you an idea, and to everyone who wrote to him, who took the time to find that address on my website and write to this young man in Puerto Rico when he was in Puerto Rico, you get gold stars. You know you do. You know you do. That was such a decent thing to do, you know, just to reach a hand out to this kid by writing to him. I'm just, you know, I think about stuff like that when I start to think that George Bush and Dick Cheney are turning all of us into just swill, you know, and then a Victor Lopez story comes up and I just go, wow, okay. Uncle Mike's Story Corner coming up here after the bottom of the hour break. A couple of emails here about what we were talking about the madness of George Bush and Dick Cheney and what to do at this point. Something has to be done. I don't think we're in any kind of doubt about that. Something has to be done. I don't know that this country can hold on for another 14 months. I really don't. Bush has made it clear at that press conference the other day that murder is on his mind, and murder and attacking yet a third country is still on the table, and the use of nuclear weapons, although he didn't mention them, is still an option. It doesn't make any difference. When someone is as insane as Bush, and the prima facie evidence of his insanity is how he responds when he is confronted publicly with the truth. A sane person does not, at that point, continue to maintain the illusion that within which he operates. You can't and remain sane. Or you can't and not be insane. So the fact that Bush has stated categorically that nothing has changed is beyond worrisome. It's again, God only knows what's going on. Remember, Secretary Gates, the Defense Secretary, is not the Gates was forced on Bush when this filthy zombie Rumsfeld had to resign in disgrace. Gates comes from the old guard. He comes from I'm not saying he comes from the right neighborhood. He doesn't. He comes from the group that tried to advise Pappy Bush way back in the day. So Gates trails behind him a certain amount of indiscretion. Let's be very gentle here. But by the same token, I don't think Robert Gates is a madman. I honestly believe that Rumsfeld was. There seems to be a streak of mental illness that runs through so many. I watched tonight on the NewsHour on public broadcasting, Jim Lehrer's interview with Negroponte. And it was just, I mean, unbelievable to see what appeared to be someone from beyond the grave, Negroponte, sitting there with his jaw moving and words coming out of his mouth and listening to what he was saying. It was just, and Negroponte is supposed to be one of the people who was moved out of the intelligence. You know, he was the head of intelligence for a while. And the story is that Negroponte was trying to explain to Bush and Cheney that the intelligence wasn't there for a Iranian nuclear weapons program. And as a result, he was moved out. And this guy, McConnell, was brought in. That's the story. Which doesn't mean that Negroponte is not just as sick and as much of a flesh eater as the rest of these people. But to watch this group, Gates is not part of the Cheney, Negroponte, Elliot Abrams, Irving Libby group. Gates is not. Gates is part of the Brent Scowcroft group. And that crowd, again, which doesn't mean that these are saviors of the American way, but these are people who would not initiate a war, a nuclear war, out of their own insanity. Bush and Cheney, obviously, are two who would. So, again, I honestly believe that what is occurring, and I don't know if it's going to take hold. I don't know if it's going to clamp down. But what's occurring is an attempt by the upper levels of the intelligence establishment in this country and the military establishment to prevent Bush from taking us into a nuclear war of catastrophic proportions. Now, when we come back, Uncle Mike's Story Corner, you want to hear this. I'm breaking bread with their benevolent host who never sold from the rich to give to the poor. All he ever gave to them was a war and a foreign enemy to deplore. Let them eat war. Let them eat war. That's how the Russian applause.
The Mike Malloy Show. You are now entering a flying monkey free zone.
Don't you dare to try and stop us.
It's about 26 before the hour. And now, ladies and gentlemen, once again, boys and girls, it's time for Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Ah, yes. Gather around. Everybody comfy? It's pretty cold out tonight. Got your snugglies on, nice glass of hot chocolate, or a cup of hot chocolate, glass. Uncle Mike is a little goofy tonight, isn't he? All right, let's gather around while Uncle Mike shares a story with you tonight. This comes to us from Douglas Herman. And it was written some time ago, and for those of you who follow Uncle Mike's Story Corner religiously, you'll pardon the pun, know that Uncle Mike has already done this story once before, but Uncle Mike believes it was more than a year or two ago. So we'll do it again tonight. It's entitled Day One, The War with Iran. The war began as planned. The Israeli pilots took off well before dawn and streaked across Lebanon and northern Iraq, high above Kirkuk. Flying U.S.-made F-15s and F-16s, the Israelis separated over the mountains of western Iran. The pilots gesturing a last-minute show of confidence in their mission, maintaining radio silence. Just before the sun rose over to Iran, moments before the Muslim call to prayer, the missiles struck their targets. While U.S. Air Force AWACS planes circled overhead, listening, watching, recording, heavy U.S. bombers followed minutes later. Bunker busters and mini nukes fell on dozens of targets, while Iranian anti-aircraft missiles sped skyward. The ironically named Bushehr nuclear power plant crumbled to dust. Russian technicians and foreign nationals scurried for safety. Most did not make it. Targets in Sakhand and Yazd, all of them carefully chosen many months before by Pentagon planners, were destroyed. The uranium enrichment facility at Natanz, a heavy water plant and radioisotope facility at Arak, the Ardakan nuclear fuel unit, the uranium conversion facility and nuclear technology center in Isfahan were struck simultaneously by U.S. Air Force and Israeli bomber groups. The Tehran Nuclear Research Center, the Tehran Molybdenum Iodine and Xenon Radioisotope Production Facility, the Tehran Jaber Ibn Hayyan Multipurpose Laboratories, the Kalai Electric Company, and the Tehran suburbs were destroyed. Iranian fighter jets rose in scattered groups, at least those Iranian fighter planes that had not been destroyed on the ground by swift and systematic airstrikes from U.S. and Israeli missiles. A few Iranian fighters even launched missiles, downing the occasional attacker, but American top guns quickly prevailed in the ensuing dogfights. The Iranian Air Force, like the Iranian Navy, never really knew what hit them. Like the slumbering U.S. sailors at Pearl Harbor, the pre-dawn preemptive attack wiped out fully half the Iranian defense forces in a matter of hours. By mid-morning, the second and third wave of U.S.-Israeli raiders screamed over the secondary targets. The only problem now, the surprising effectiveness of the Iranian missile defenses. The element of surprise lost, U.S. and Israeli warplanes began to fall from the skies in considerable numbers to anti-aircraft fire. At 7:30 a.m. Tehran time, the first Iranian anti-ship missile destroyed a Panamanian oil tanker departing from Kuwait and bound for Houston. Launched from an Iranian fighter plane, the Exocet split the ship in half and set the ship ablaze in the Strait of Hormuz. A second and third tanker followed, black smoke billowing from the broken ships before they blew up and sank. By 8:15 a.m., all ship traffic on the Persian Gulf had ceased. U.S. Navy ships ordered earlier into the relative safety of the Indian Ocean south of their base in Bahrain launched counterstrikes. Waves of U.S. fighter planes circled the burning wrecks in the bottleneck of Hormuz, but the Iranian fighters had fled. At 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, many hours into the war, CNN reported a squadron of suicide Iranian fighter jets attacking the U.S. Navy fleet south of Bahrain. Embedded reporters aboard the ships, sending live feeds directly to a rapt audience of Americans just awakening, reported all of the Iranian jets destroyed, but not before the enemy planes launched dozens of Exocet and Sunburn anti-ship missiles. A U.S. aircraft carrier, cruiser, and two destroyers suffered direct hits. The cruiser blew up and sank, killing 600 men. The aircraft carrier sank an hour later. By mid-morning, every military base in Iran was partially or wholly destroyed. Sirens blared and fires blazed from hundreds of fires. Explosions rocked Tehran and the electrical power failed. The Al Jazeera news station in Tehran took a direct hit from a satellite bomb, leveling the entire block. At 9:15 a.m. Baghdad time, the first Iranian missile struck the green zone. For the next 30 minutes, a torrent of missiles landed on GPS coordinates carefully selected by Shiite militiamen with cell phones positioned outside the green zone, and other permanent U.S. bases. Although U.S. and Israeli bomber pilots had destroyed 90% of the Iranian missiles, enough Shahabs remained to fully destroy the green zone, the Baghdad airport, and a U.S. Marine base. Thousands of unsuspecting U.S. soldiers died in the early morning barrage. Not surprisingly, CNN and Fox withheld the great number of casualties from American viewers. By 9:30 a.m., gas stations on the U.S. East Coast began to raise their prices. Slowly at first, and then altogether in a panic, the prices rose. $4 a gallon, then $5, then $6. The prices skyrocketed. Worried motorists rushing from work roared into the nearest gas station, radios blaring the latest reports of the preemptive strike on Iran. While fistfights broke out in gas stations everywhere, the third Middle Eastern war had begun. In Washington, D.C., the spin began minutes after the first missile struck its intended target. The punitive strike, not really a war, said the harried White House spokesman, the punitive strike would further democracy and peace in the Middle East. Media pundits mostly followed the party line. By ridding Iran of weapons of mass destruction, Robert Gates declared confidently on CNN, Iran might follow in the footsteps of Iraq and enjoy the hard-won fruits of freedom. The president scheduled a speech at 2 p.m. Gas prices rose another $2 before then. China and Japan threatened to dump U.S. dollars. Gold rose another $120 an ounce. The dollar plummeted against the euro. CNN reported violent anti-American protests in Paris, London, Rome, Berlin, and Dublin. Fast food franchises throughout Europe carrying American corporate logos were firebombed. A violent coup toppled the pro-American Pakistan president. On the New York Stock Exchange, prices fell in a frenzy of trading, except for the major petroleum producers. A single Iranian Shahab missile struck Tel Aviv, destroying an entire city block. Israel vowed revenge and threatened a nuclear strike on Tehran before a hastily called UN General Assembly in New York City eased tensions. An orange alert in New York City suddenly reddened to a full-scale terror alarm when a package detonated on a Manhattan subway. Mayor Bloomberg declared martial law. Governor Pataki ordered the New York... Governor Spitzer ordered the New York National Guard fully mobilized, mobilizing what few National Guardsmen remained in the state. President Bush looked shaken at 2 p.m. The scroll below the TV screen reported Persian Gulf nations halting production of oil until the conflict could be resolved. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez announced a freeze in oil deliveries to the U.S. would begin immediately. The British Prime Minister offered to mediate peace negotiations between the U.S. and Israel and Iran, but was resoundingly rejected. By 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, gas prices had stabilized at just below $10 a gallon. A Citgo station in Texas near Fort Sam Houston Army Base was firebombed. No one claimed responsibility. Terrorism was not ruled out. At sunset, the call to prayer in Tehran, Baghdad, Islamabad, Ankara, Jerusalem, Jakarta, and Riyadh sounded uncannily like the buzzing of enraged bees. Oh, Uncle Mike's story corner tonight was a spooky one. Huh, kiddies? Finish up your cocoa. Don't forget to eat the marshmallows that we put on top for you. And then off to bed. Tonight's Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Day 1, The War with Iran, was written by Douglas Herman, United States Air Force veteran. From Lauren. Hi, Mike. I don't know what you can do, but I... regarding Bush and Cheney, but I sure worry about you all. She's Lawrence writing from Canada. My family in California doesn't seem to notice that there's anything wrong. My sister in San Francisco thinks her congresswoman, Nancy Pelosi, is fabulous. My stepfather got horribly offended when I told him I refused to visit the States because it would be like visiting Nazi Germany in the 30s. My family's lives go on. There are weddings, holidays. My rantings fall on deaf or incredulous ears. I think it's going to take high-level people doing something. There have been those two incidents, the revelation of the 6 missing cruise missiles and the recent announcement that Iran isn't really out to get you. The normal American doesn't seem to know or care.
All your charm is offered in your defense. If you're perfect and comfortable, commit to a man. Are you perfectly comfortable going to war without moral sanction against the law? Are you perfectly comfortable fighting the world? If you're perfectly
Prime Minister and I discussed the humanitarian needs. We understand the fright that can come when you're worried about a rocket landing on top of your home.
It's about 10 before the hour. Spitfire writes, I just watched a clip of NASCAR at Times Square. Meanwhile, in other places of the world, namely old Europe, they're working on cold fusion. Oh, you cynic. Let's do some of your phone calls. You folks have been incredibly, incredibly patient. Bill is calling from Los Angeles, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Bill.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Oh, fine. I'm just trying to catch the insanity that you deliver to me every day.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
No, I'm glad you do. Nobody else does. I mean, I've been listening to you for about 2 months now, and every day I look forward to my day ending so I can hear you on the radio.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's very kind.
Well, anyways, I was wondering, what is the actual possibility of these two clowns being legally liable for what they're doing?
As long as they are in office, they are immune from criminal charges. Now, in the case of against Clinton, who is the woman, Nancy? Not Nancy. What was her name? Kathy. Who is the woman that filed the lawsuit against Clinton? The trailer. Paula Jones, thank you. I don't know why I can't remember that. In Jones versus Clinton, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that a sitting president can be the defendant in a civil suit, while he's in office. But criminal charges, president, vice president, are immune from criminal charges. The only way to get at these two, as long as they're in office, is through impeachment. And that was deliberate. By the framers, they deliberately made it difficult to criminally charge a president or vice president for obvious reasons. If you had a decent couple of people running the country, and some freaks decided, okay, it's too good, we got to stop it, they would just bring charges against them, and then the president or vice president would have to defend themselves. Now. And remember, in a civil suit, all that's necessary, guilt is not determined beyond a reasonable doubt. Guilt is just determined by the preponderance of evidence. So that's why a civil suit can go forward, criminal suit can't.
Well, what they're doing is clearly intentional and criminal. And to be honest with you, I mean, sure, there are terrorists on the planet, but these guys, they are actually tearing the company, or the country apart yeah. in a terroristic way.
They are. The damage that Bush and Cheney are doing to this republic is, I mean, it's unspeakable. And but like people, you know, I get emails from people all the time that say, okay, you know, we listen to you at night, and, you know, you're a real fear-monger. Nobody cares about what you're talking about, Malloy, and you want proof of that? Look around. Christmas is coming. People are shopping. And every once in a while someone goes berserk like they did in Omaha today and starts shooting people. But other than the madness at Virginia Tech or at a shopping mall in Omaha, there's nothing wrong, Malloy. You and your listeners are crazier than bedbugs. You're all loony. You're all moonbats. Everything is fine. Everything is fine.
That's the sadness in it.
Well, but it's, yeah. Oh, I agree with you. Absolutely, Bill. But In a very perverse way, it's also true. If things weren't fine, then why? I mean, if we're on the verge of destruction, on the verge of Bush and Cheney taking us into a nuclear conflict, then why aren't we aware of it? Why aren't we in the streets? Why isn't our news media, or why aren't our news media just beating the drums to stop these sons of bitches? Where's the New York Times? Where's the Washington Post, ABC, CBS, NBC? Where is everybody? It's like, it's not, you know, every once in a while I start thinking it's not Bush and Cheney and their gang that's insane. It's you, Malloy.
Yep.
You're crazy. You're crazy. You're out of your mind.
I think it's the American people that, I mean, we should be stopping this. We need to stop this. I mean, I would love to see their assets frozen. I would love to see an account somehow made for repairing America. I would like to see these guys sitting, you know, in the prison there with the rest of the terrorists with no chance of ever getting a lawyer.
I hear you.
I would love to see that, and I wish the American people would stand up and say enough is enough, because if it comes down to an armed revolution, I mean, with what happened here with the information that was just leaked out, you know, by the military heads or who it be, that just goes to show Bush and Cheney that you don't have the military behind you.
Well, it may show them that, at least a certain element of the military, but when the rubber hits the road, how many flag rank officers are going to participate in a mutiny? Now, it's one thing to refuse an order that an officer feels is not a legitimate order. It's that's allowed, insisted upon in the military code. But it's something else again for someone like Admiral Fallon to utterly and absolutely refuse a policy decision to launch an attack, in other words, to start a war. That goes way beyond refusing what a soldier, a Marine, might consider an illegal order. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, yeah.
That requires mutiny. So up to this point, yeah, I think it's coming from Admiral Fallon and two or three high-ranking officers on his level, and it's also, I honestly believe, coming from very high-placed members of the intelligence establishment. But what happens if Bush and or Cheney absorb this blow and then say, "All right, bomb them now"? Will these people, if such a resistance already exists, will they have the courage to resist that? If they do, then we are in a situation where we have a mutiny on our hands. And you know what, Bill? I think the American public would continue to just go to the mall. Bill, I got to leave it there. Thanks, pal. I appreciate
you. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. Take care. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
like a drunk in the midnight choir. I have tried in my way to be free. Like a fish on a hook, like a knife.
Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program on Nova M Radio. Let's go to your phone calls. And I appreciate the patience here. Dan is calling from Montclair, New Jersey, listening on the internet. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. You know, that bedtime story just keeps getting better. Remember the last time you read it? Good Lord. I'm a father of two little girls, and, you know, I take my older one to the rallies, and she's happy to be part of it. She's 8.
Mm-hmm.
And today when I got off the phone with Pelosi's office, she said, Daddy, why doesn't anybody just sue him? And I'm glad you answered that question so I can let her know about that. But this week, I called Pelosi's office like on Monday because I'd had enough. And that's one of the things I do is I call my rep and my senators. And I figured, Pelosi, I gotta, you know, they've got to know, why is impeachment off the table? You know, she said it. It's off the table. So her office will know. So I called, and I got a nice young man who said, I can't answer that. She hasn't really given us information. Let me put you on the line with her, and you leave a message. So immediately you go and I leave a message. You're derelict in your duties, upholding the Constitution, blah, blah, blah. And I get off the phone, and Daddy, do you feel any better? I said, no, not really. And then I heard the press conference and, you know, how he spun that,
right,
the intelligence report. And, well, so today I decided, you know, I'm going to call back. And I've given that he's lied to us again or he's incompetent, why is it still off the table? And I got a woman who... It was even faster. Quick, you got to go to the voicemail. I can't talk. Goodbye.
Good God.
It's sick. I think everybody needs to call Pelosi's office, though, and fill her voicemail up full of, you know, America needs to know why now after umpteen hundred lies, it seems,
mm-hmm,
impeachment, you know, what Clinton did compared to what these criminals have done.
I did not have sex with that woman, Ms. Lewinsky. Compare that to this warmongering degenerate. It is astonishing that the Republicans 10 years ago were so willing, eager to use the U.S. Constitution as toilet paper in order to discredit Bill Clinton, to impeach him on something as ridiculous as his perjury trap that he was gotten into by the very right-wingers who wound up trying to get him convicted in the Senate. And now we have this, and some of the same people who were so willing to march across the Capitol Rotunda and present their case to the Senate are still sitting in the House, and they're still Republicans, and they're still evil, mean-spirited sons of bitches. Now that we have a real threat to this republic, a threat that is so intense it could end this republic, they just sit there. They don't do anything. It's astonishing.
I must say the one thing I do that also helps me keep sane is I co-chair a drinking liberally group. It helps to get out amongst the fellow people who feel they're insane and have a couple drinks. Some of us are, you know, some of the people in the group don't drink alcohol, but they drink, you know, soda water.
Right,
but
right.
We get out and we can commiserate and we can keep our spouses from kicking us out of the house. Thank you. You're an inspiration, both of you.
Well, I appreciate you checking in, Dan. Take care. Take care. I remember talking with Dan. Yeah, I remember at least one call from him, probably more.
I think we get email. I know I get email from Dan talking about taking his daughters to protests and whatnot. I'm almost certain it's the same guy. And I also wanted to say, when you guys were talking and my mind was drifting back to the lies of this administration and the impeachable offenses versus Clinton, I just wanted to chime in with a caller the other night, a woman, and I can't remember her name, called in and said, isn't it ironic or isn't it coincidental that Valerie Plame was in Iran researching exactly this stuff? Maybe, and it makes you wonder, if maybe her outing was not all about revenge against Joe Wilson for their yellow cake uranium lie about Niger. you know, for don't forget that whopper. Mm-hmm. But maybe it was also to end her work.
Yeah.
And her discovery that there was no proliferation going on.
Right, her presenting a program. Because between Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame, it would have been a 1-2 punch. One, there is no there in Iraq. Two, there is no there in Iran. I mean, when you stop and think, I don't know what Valerie Plame would have reported because of her work as a CIA operative gathering information about Iran. But just for the sake of argument, assume that she would have told the truth, as Joe Wilson did. I don't think that's too much of a stretch. Maybe it is. But if they both told the truth, then this couple would have blown holes in the warmongering foreign policy approach of Bush and Cheney.
So it's not, you know, all along we've been operating on the premise that it was strictly a revenge outing. And it could have been that she was as much a target as Wilson. She may have been the primary target. And how scary is it that how many agents' lives were put at risk, or how many agents in the field lost their lives?
Right.
How many assets, as they call them, were ruined? And they don't care. That, yeah, just another crime. And why did we impeach Clinton?
Yeah, right. Well, as far as agents in the field being in jeopardy, I not to be argumentative here, Madam Producer, but I think what they're talking about, when they were talking about people, the possibility of people losing their lives, they were talking about the people hired, in a sense, the, as you point out, the assets. I don't think there were any CIA agents who were iced because of the outing of Valerie Plame. But I think you're right, and I think other people who have guessed on this are also right, that there were foreign nationals that we were using, some of whom I'm sure were Iranians, some of whom were Iraqis, some of whom were Kurds, since the Bush crime family is financing Kurdish incursions into northern Iran to blow things up and kill people. We have a truly criminal regime in charge here. Truly. Back to your calls. Ron is calling from PA. Is this Ron lost in PA?
That would be me.
Hey, Ron.
What's up?
Good to hear from you.
Yeah, I don't really... I think the one caller earlier kind of pointed to the fact that there's a type of apathy that's just insurmountable. And I think you were talking about it too, like people just going about their business, mm-hmm. you know. And I really don't know what it would take, what catalyzing event could actually, you know, move people into action. I think that we've really lost, you know, a personal sense of responsibility, mm-hmm. you know, for the protection of our country. It's been sort of like, you know, slowly pilfered away from us.
And when you think of that word responsibility or responsible, what that means is able to respond.
Yes.
And that's what we've lost. The responsibility or the ability to respond or being able to respond. And this is the part that is really starting to scare me deeply, Ron, that the American public, that all of us have become so immobilized through some mechanism, I don't know what, that we're allowing this to go on and on and on.
Well, I think there's a great denial in a lot of respects. I mean, I think people medicate themselves by shopping or whatever, you know. I mean, hell, you know, Bush, you know, that was his prescription for 9/11. Yeah, take your family to Disneyland, go shopping, you know? And it's, I think people are just sort of like, maybe they're just dumbfounded. And maybe they just don't have the, whatever, the emotional capacity to really grasp what's happening. I think some, I can't remember who I was listening to, but they kind of, this person, he was like Bernie Sanders, I think, made a point. You know, that if people really understood, if there was something like nefarious going on with 9/11, mm-hmm. it would be too much for them.
Yeah, and would wind up rejecting that too. Ron, thanks. I got a break here. Don't be a stranger. Your emails are wonderful. I love what you write. But, yeah, call in occasionally. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Got us started on the wrong road to 9/11. And since that day, by our own leader, we have been driven to the edge of Armageddon. Bill Clinton told a lie, Bush lies, and people die.
Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's more Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. Mary in Denver writes, Mike, who would have thunk it? The spooks and the brass have seemingly united in a silent coup to block Bush and Cheney's assiduously planned and totally insane attack on Iran. Is this the end of the military-industrial complex? Perhaps even major silent corporate conspirators have had enough. But our masochistic Democratic congressional leaders have not had enough. I fear they will fold and bend once again to Bush bluster and petulant threats. Here's more monopoly money, George, for our beloved troops. And our despicable media continue to feature pundits who have been wrong, wrong, wrong about everything for 7 years, while silencing the voices of sanity. And the American people remain largely ignorant of the stakes in this deadly game. So, other than screaming at the moon in unison, what hope do we have? How about a cabal of physicians close to the executive palace? Hello, 25th Amendment. Please, doctors, remember Hippocrates and save us all from harm. Now that comes from Mary in Denver, and Barry, who writes from, where is Barry? Is he in the States? I think he is. Here's what Barry writes. Subject line is the best thing to do. I think maybe the best thing to do would be to encourage more psychiatric professionals to join effort with Justin Frank. It was a therapist with a doctor who first told me that Bush had narcissistic personality disorder, and this was before the Iraq invasion. I didn't realize it was true until the time Bush claimed to have done more for civil rights than any president. But it was true, and Bush is extremely ill. Won't anybody in the field join efforts with Dr. Frank? It's a responsibility of the profession as a whole. As for Cheney, he's more your run-of-the-mill evil son of a bitch than Bush is. Dr. Frank says Cheney and the rest of them do it for the money. But Bush is sick in a more traditional sense. I wonder. I wonder why there is not a response to this madness from the psychiatric community. I'm serious. Don't they have an obligation? I don't know that they do. Physicians, medical doctors, seem to rise to some sort of responsible action when there is a public health threat, don't they? If it's a threat to physical health, advocating some sort of prevention or treatment when there's a threat to the nation's physical health. And sometimes to not very good results. Remember the swine flu, the so-called swine flu epidemic. Remember that debacle. So does the psychiatric establishment, which are also MDs, but let's forget the psychiatric establishment for just a moment. And how about the establishment of psychologists, the PhDs, MSWs? Do they not have a responsibility? We're talking about mental health here. And we're talking about it from either a cognitive awareness point of view or a Freudian point of view or some sort of therapeutic point of view, short of medication and or intervention, chemical intervention. And a third choice, why not both the psychiatric and the psychologic community joining forces to voice a clear opinion that comes with the force that would come, in the equivalent of the Journal of the American Medical Association, in some publication that this brain dead media of ours would pick up on, but a co-authored piece that says something to the effect of, you know, these people are, by all appearances, I mean, you never know until you really examine somebody or test them, but by all appearances, these people are clinically insane. It's easier for me or for you to talk about the insanity of these people, but if we want a real clinical diagnosis, then that's what's needed, is what I'm trying to say. And I don't think, to answer my own query here, there may not be physicians and MDs, psychiatrists, who are willing to go on the record without sitting down with Bush and Cheney. On the other hand, if you see somebody across the room who's coughing and hacking and their skin is flushed and mucus is pouring out of their nose and they're holding their head, you can pretty well make an educated guess that they have some sort of infection. You know, I go back to Dylan. You don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing. So I just wonder if there's any chance, and I know the answer to the question, that the psychiatric or psychologic community could come to our rescue?
The Mike Malloy Show, because each time you listen to Right Wing Radio, God kills a kitten.
Nobody was ever gonna get sized down.
It's about 25 before the hour. Kathy in Green Bay writes regarding the doctor's suggestion. A few years ago, my neurologist mentioned that he had written to his member of Congress and to the vice president, when it was George Herbert Walker Bush, to express deep concern about President Reagan. He never got a response. Apparently, Reagan's Alzheimer's was very evident to the professionals during his presidency. What kind of response would a physician get today if he or she were to comment on Bush? Would anyone pay attention? How many people want to admit there's a madman at the helm? Yeah, and the other choice there, Kathy, is how many people want to be visited by someone who says, you know, your letter is a threat to the president, your inquiry about his mental health. We'd like to question you at a federal building here in your city. Regarding the story day one that we read on Uncle Mike's Story Corner, Bill in Ottawa, Canada writes, wow, good stuff. That's the kind of piece that has impact. The problem with a lot of what America does is that they don't think 15 seconds beyond bomb them into the Stone Age, the meme. A well-written piece like this is a wonderful way to scare people, and scaring people is what we need to do. I tracked the article down on Rents and immediately sent it to everyone on my mailing list. I was also happy to hear from the Canadian woman because I tell my friends the same thing she does. Don't travel to America. Don't trade with America. It's just like traveling or trading with the Nazis in 1936. and like her, I get pretty much the same reaction. Huh? What are you talking about? We get our news from CNN, too. From a strictly Canadian point of view, I'm worried about us. As the Middle East burns, the baleful eye of Cheney, the undead, will inevitably turn north and fix on our oil. A few years ago, there was a poll in America about the advisability of America invading Canada. And I forgot, but something like 40% of you thought that was a good idea. When my 87-year-old father heard that, he said, I fought the Nazis in World War II, and if the Americans come here, I will fight them. Bill from Ottawa. I don't think the oil companies, Bill, not for a number of years in the future, are really interested in Canadian oil. Most of it is shale oil, right? And the extraction process would burn more energy than it would produce, or something like that. I remember reading something about that. I'm trying to sound smart, and I just failed. Tom is calling from Southern Pines, North Carolina, listening on the Internet. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Hey, listen, great quality is well worth the wait.
Well, thank you. Well,
you're talking about sanding and all, but I think what's happening with people like me and you is that if you're a sane person living in a country ruled by insane people, you feel like you're insane.
Yeah, it does feel that way sometimes.
And I think what needs to be done, just I don't want to monopolize your time. I just want to make a quick point now and let you go on to the next caller because the show's great, is that if we really want to get Bush and Cheney out, which they need to be out, which I hope when Molly's in college, you can take a course and see them in jail, is that we have to be patient and have a plan like they did, like the Wolfowitz-Cheney plan of 1992, which was to preemptively strike a Middle Eastern country, not Saudi Arabia, of course,
right,
occupy it and control it.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to fly that by Clinton, and he said, you know, go fly a kite. But they got the opportunity on 9/11 to do it. Now, we need to wait till after the next election when they're out of office, when they're civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And then there will be fresh meat.
Well, I wonder if they would be immune from prosecution under America's criminal code. They don't live in a state. They live in a district. So, you know, the state of Washington, D.C. doesn't exist. So they couldn't be prosecuted under state law. I just wonder, maybe somebody will send me an email on that. I don't know how that works. If Bush and Cheney escape prosecution, the only way the Constitution calls for it, and that's in the Senate after an indictment, the impeachment in the House, if they escape that, then other than international war crimes,
that might be where you can check it off, and that might be the case.
Yeah, it just looks bleaker and bleaker. It's like these guys figured out long ago that they could dance on as many graves as they felt like dancing on and get away with it. And I don't know. I don't know, Tom. It's freaky.
Well, it's very freaky, Mike, because I tell you, I'm an artist, I'm a painter, and what's the correlation between now and 1936 Germany? If you're familiar with the Bauhaus Art School, you know, all the artists had to flee because of their progressive thought.
Right, right.
And many artists are starting to flee. I'm contemplating doing it. And, you know, I've got many somewhat controversial political things I'd love to show, and I'm terrified to show them.
Mm.
You know, and I shouldn't be. They're not. They're true.
Mm-hmm.
The truth hurts. But, you know, and one more thing real quick, Mike, is that I'm calling you from North Carolina, and I do teach also, and this is very sad, but, you know, you're talking about the apathy point. You know, I was teaching a little boy one time, and I teach a lot of kids, and I try to do a word association to learn kids' names. And I said, you know, what's your name, young man? He goes, my name's Jason. And I said, okay, well, I'm a Washington Redskins fan. You know, Jason Campbell's my favorite quarterback. And he goes, oh, he was my daddy's favorite quarterback, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, who's your daddy's favorite quarterback now? And he goes, my daddy died in Iraq.
Oh, God.
And I asked the guy who owned the club I worked at, you know, what's the deal with this boy? You know, I want to try and call the Redskins, get him a football sign. He goes, here's the apathy point. Oh, it's no big deal. His dad died 2 years ago.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, God.
Yeah. You know, come, God, I mean, come on.
I know.
Give me a break here. Death is death. Blood is blood. And this has got to stop, and we've got to have a plan which says, all right, well, let's wait. Unfortunately, Cheney will drop dead of a heart attack before he'll ever see any jail time. But maybe at least history can say this is the blackest time in the history of America, and we've got to do something about it. If not, they've tarnished our great world image. After 9/11, we had the whole world at our fingertips. They said, every country, including Iran, how can we help
you? Sure.
And all that Bush did with his hand, he didn't stick his hand out. He stuck his middle finger out and told everybody what they could do. And
yeah.
That's appalling. It's appalling. And the apathy point is a great point. And thank God for people like you. You're sane. That's why people don't like you. Because we're living in an insane world. But the ones of us here who are educated and sane, we love you, and keep on doing what you're doing, man.
Well, thanks, Tom. I appreciate it. Take care. Take care. You know. Totalitarianism, you know, whether it's funked out communism or Nazism, totalitarianism hates an artist or a poet. Those are usually among the first to be squashed. And as Tom pointed out, the artist or the poet either has to flee or stop writing or stop painting. Look at the Soviet Union going all the way back to Lenin and Stalin, all the way up to Gorbachev. Again, I've mentioned before, one of my favorite writers is a Russian, Mikhail Bulgakov, and one of my favorite books, the favorite book of his, probably my favorite book of all the Russian writers. And yes, I've tried to read them. Some of them I just can't get through. But Bulgakov, who wrote The Master and Margarita, and he wrote it either during the 20s or the 30s, during the Stalinist purges. And it's a masterwork. It shows exactly how this particular writer, who was an anti-totalitarian, he was anti the murderous regime of Stalin, and yet the only way he could write was in the way he did it. And his writings were published in Russia, in the Soviet Union. And apparently these dumb bastards never understood fully what Bulgakov was writing. But if you're going to take any time off over Christmas, I just strongly recommend Mikhail Bulgakov's book, The Master and Margarita. You read that book, and you will be astonished. It was either written in the 20s or the early 30s. I want to say the 20s, 1920s, and early 1930s. Probably the 30s, because the revolution was only in 1917. So probably in the 30s. But if you read it, I haven't read it in about 5 years, but 6 years. But as I remember, what I read then, 5 or 6 years ago, from this from the book, The Master and Margarita, would apply so perfectly to George W. Bush. 10 before the hour, thanks to the crew, Ian Huff, who engineered the program and handled your phone calls at our flagship station, KPHX in Phoenix. Also, Billy Foster, our technical director, who keeps all the balls in the air. Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent. Catherine Bay is our executive producer. A.E. writes in, Mike, when one person is insane, they can be declared insane. When a complete segment of society is insane, they're declared a political party. What the hell does that mean? Okay. And Prairie 2 writes, Mike, prosecution of former presidents is possible. They announced Reagan's dementia to avoid answering for Iran-Contra. There was talk of charging Clinton once he left office. Impeachment is just a way of skipping ahead. Okay, that's true. I'm losing all reference points where it concerns precedent and law and so on and so forth. And it's, when you live in what is turning into a society run by outlaws, it's easy, at least it is for me, to forget that. Oh yeah, that's right. There are the Reagan deposition. I remember seeing a video of that. Didn't he answer, I can't recall, regarding Iran-Contra over 125 times in what amounted to like a 90-minute deposition? Isn't that, am I way off base here? I think that's the case. And Clinton, yeah, Clinton got disbarred, all sorts of things. So, yeah, you can be brought to justice, so to speak. Back to your phone calls. Mr. Bill is calling from Allentown, PA. Mr. Bill, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike. Hey, I'd like to say hello to Bob, Carol, Chef Scott, and PPUK. They're all on the in the chat room.
Okay.
So I just want to say hello to them.
Yeah.
And when I was listening to your story corner tonight, I was kind of thinking about Kennedy in '62,
uh-huh.
What if Bush was back there back then? What kind of world would it be today? I'm kind of swimming in that, and I've been. You know, my mind's just been a piece full of what.
Yeah, right. I
I'm trying to keep my mouth from saying things that.
Thank you.
Get you off the air.
Thank you. Get you off the air.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Right. But no, I appreciate your discretion for sure.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean about how your mind starts to feel like it's just rattling around somewhere inside this organ in your skull called your brain, and it's not it's not attached to anything anymore. That's the crazy part for me. I always felt anchored my entire life, maybe anchored to bad stuff at different times, you know, because I've done some things that would be considered reprobate, and I've done some really crappy stuff. Who hasn't? But I always felt anchored nonetheless. All of a sudden, at this stage in my life, which is not a good time to feel without an anchor, I feel without an anchor, and it's scary. It gets scary, man.
Well, you know what? Right before, between the time between December 12th and Inauguration Day, Bush's Inauguration Day, one of my neighbors said to me, wait till you see, there's going to be another war in about a year or so.
Well, your neighbor was right.
Yeah. Well, he was thinking about it back to his daddy, you know.
Yeah.
The piano tuner just came back into the chat room. Hello, John.
All right, Mr. Bill. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you checking in. I'm a drop point for everybody in the chat room. The piano tuner, that would be John Neems. We got time? We do. Rob is calling from Minnesota, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Rob.
Hi there, Mike.
How you doing?
I want to be able to take and tell you right away. It's where you and Kathy are two of some of the best people out there. I hope Kathy gives you a hug for me tonight because I probably never will.
You're probably right there.
You know, the only thing is where, you know, I think that America right now is in a catch-22 situation. It's where the information that they're being fed is almost like a George Orwell situation, you know. It's where they don't know exactly what to do and how to do it. And they don't know if what they're saying to anybody else is being heard from somebody else, you know. And it's kind of tough out here right now. I mean, you have a better knowledge than me than to be able to take and talk to people about these things. But right now, I mean, I wonder sometimes as far as people talking to you and even myself that we could be putting ourselves in peril to be able to take and do these things, you know?
Well, I have to admit, I do think about that. Kathy and I have discussed that. We do have a three-year-old. We discussed the weird reality of doing what we do in the age of Bush, but it's not just us. I think any liberal or progressive talk show host is facing the same possibility. I think Jeff Farias on our station in Phoenix. I think Randy Rhodes on our network. I think Tom Hartman. Just on and on. People who take the point of view that we take with these new directives and executive orders that have been signed by Bush, I guess there's some amount of risk, and I don't want to make a big deal about it or minimize it, but it's something we do talk about. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, everybody, for hanging out tonight. We do appreciate it. We'll see you tomorrow night, okay? Take care. And keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.